If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
The garden has chaster elements and rather sort of sexy elements. Mm. It has classicism, which is rational, and it has a gothic, which is exotic.
Yeah. That was Timothy Mole discussing the appeal of the historic Rousham House and Gardens.
So the thing is, if you give Latin Americans a crown, they will want to entertain. Whereas I think Northern European nations, for the most part, want to get a job done. You know, they want a victory.
And that was Andreas Campomar talking to us about Latin American football. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. It's available in all good newsagents, or you can take out a subscription from wherever you are. Visit historyextra.com/subscribe for our latest subscription deals. And we also have digital editions available for the iPad, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. For details of these, visit historyextra.com/digital. The 18th century saw a revolution in garden landscaping, headed by the Yorkshire-born artist and architect William Kent, whose informal, free-flowing designs could be found at country houses across England. We sent our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, armed with an umbrella, to meet Professor Timothy Mole at Rousham Gardens in Oxfordshire to find out more about the remarkable polymath who contributed so much to English garden history.
Okay, so Tim, we're standing here in the rain at Rousham Gardens in Oxfordshire. Tell us a little bit about what we're looking at now.
Well, we're in Venus's Vale, which is the heart of the garden, the sort of sexual heart of the garden in many ways. And there are two cascades in front of us, two arched structures, one quite close and one in the distance. And on top of the one in the distance is Venus. She's a modest Venus. She's naked and she's hiding her modesty. and she is protected by two very fierce swans. But on the left and the right of her, one statue of a Pan and the other one of a leering fawn.
They're rather sinister, aren't they?
They're oppressing her sexually. And this is the whole point of this part of the garden. It's Kent's mind games with us to suggest that we have sex, we have oppression in the middle of this garden.
Yeah. And why was he, I mean, was he given free rein to design the garden? Was he, you know, why did he decide to make this sort of subject?
Good question. I mean, General Dormer, the owner who got him in the late 1730s, early 1840s, got him to do two drawings of the garden as Kent envisaged it. But then Kent was hardly ever here, and most of the planting that went on was done by the steward and the head gardener. The head gardener, particularly a man called John McClary, was very important in laying it out. So although Kent suggested where garden buildings should go and how the design should be effected, he was hardly ever here to sort it out.
And is this a typical landscape garden of the time?
It is of this early 18th century period. The whole point of these gardens is they're meant to be interactive, both physically but intellectually as well.
Yeah.
So you don't walk around them and look at lovely shows of daffs. Everything is very, very intellectual and sophisticated. One has to know the classics particularly, because often these gardens have Latin inscriptions, and garden buildings and statues are all telling a story. Yeah. And the great thing about this garden is the way in which Kent takes us around the garden in this original design of his, and we're meant to look at various places and we're meant to think certain things.
Okay, so I mean, where else would you, in the garden, would you say is particularly sort of typical of, you know, of Kent trying to get a message across to people?
By the house, there's a bowling green, which was part of the original design by Charles Bridgeman. Kent came along and softened Bridgeman's rather angular lines, and at that point there's a terrace, and you look out into the landscape from the terrace, high up above the declivity and the River Charwell in the bottom of the valley.
Yeah.
And you're meant to look at nature and see that nature outside the garden is all part of the garden. And Kent did this very cleverly by putting garden structures, even on land that the Dormers didn't own, to bring the country, calling in the country to be part of the landscape. So that's a very clever way in which he leapt the bounds and saw that all nature was a garden. At that point, there are little Gothic seats, and next to them are classical homes with classical deities, heads of classical deities.
Yeah.
And these all tell an intellectual story at the time.
I mean, these gardens were incredibly popular, weren't they, during the 18th century?
Yeah.
Where did they originate? What caused the gardens to change in their design?
Well, Kent particularly spent 9 years in Rome, and when he came back from Italy, he could speak sort of quite bad Italian, actually better than his English. He had very odd English because he was a Yorkshireman.
Okay.
That's not to say that Yorkshireman have got bad English, but his Italian was probably a bit better, certainly written anyway.
Yeah.
So he would have seen all the great gardens in the Roman Campania, and particularly Palestrina, and one of his garden buildings, Praeneste, which is a beautiful arcaded loggia here, is inspired by the terraces at Palestrina. So it's effectively an Italianate garden, but in England, in the climate that we've got, as we've said before, it's pouring with rain here at the moment. But it seems to be quite perfect for a green and white garden of this period.
Would have seen these gardens? Were they open to the public?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we tend to be garden tourists now, don't we? We go all over the place to pay our National Trust entrance fee and go and see gardens. Well, in the 18th century, these gardens were open to the public, but generally when the owners weren't in residence. And on the outside of the garden, by the main road, there's what's called the Cow Castle. It's a little building for hay for the cows, but there's a seat on the outside of it, and the steward would sit at the seat and would take your ticket there as a almost like a paying guest or a paying customer coming into the garden. If you were staying with the family, of course, you would walk the garden from the house. So there are two different ways of walking the garden, one from the house and one from the main road if you're a visitor. And I sort of stress the point about walking the garden, because all of these gardens have circuits and you have to do them correctly. And one of the reasons why, you know, we need to know more about these gardens is that when people do come to walk and enjoy them. Mm. Now,
yeah,
we haven't got the classical education that they had in the 18th century, and we need to educate people to walk them correctly and to get the right nuances and excitements, yeah, and intellectual engagement that they got in the 18th century.
It's getting a bit wetter out here, so should we wander up to the...
head for Pye Nestow,
yes,
shall we?
Okay, so we've sheltered a little bit from the rain now. Tell me a little about William Kent. How did he come to design this garden?
Well, in the 1730s, after about 1733, he sort of set himself free from his main mentor, who was Lord Burlington.
Yeah.
And he'd worked with Burlington at Chiswick in London. And in the mid-1730s, he more or less set out on his own as a landscape designer. And it was said at the time that he worked without line or level. And that basically means that he would come to an estate and he would look at it, and very much like Capability Brown of the next generation, he would work out what the capabilities of the terrain were,
yeah,
and how he could reshape it and reform it and loosen up the angularities, particularly if he came to a garden like this that had already been designed.
Yeah.
So he became, in the 1730s, one of the most important landscape designers that people would go to for designs, particularly if they wanted makeovers. Because,
yeah,
it's very interesting about the 18th century. Most of the big houses are built in the 1720s, and it's the next generation that comes along that inherit both houses and gardens, and,
yeah,
they want to change things.
Yes.
So he doesn't do gardens afresh. He's all the time changing things that are already there, like he does here at Rousham.
Yeah.
So, very, very important designer until he dies in 1748. So, from 33 to 48, he's the main man. By which time, Capability Brown, who started work at Stowe, where, of course, Kent had done the Elysian Fields, a, mm-hmm, really important part of the gardens at Stowe, he was ready then to set up as the next landscape gardener. Yeah. So, it obviously goes in generations like that.
I mean, I've noticed as we were walking around, there's a lot of water incorporated into the garden.
Yeah.
Does that have any meaning? Is that just, again, to loosen up the look of the garden?
Yes. I mean, we're sitting here in Pye Nestow, which is this lovely arcaded loggia, mm, looking down. We're high up above the River Charwell, yeah, with fields in the distance. The Charwell, when he got here, had been canalised by Bridgman, so it was very angular.
Yeah.
It was like an angular canal with a right angle here.
Okay.
And he made it much more serpentine, mm, and contoured the banks of the river to make it looser and softer and smoother. And he did exactly the same with all of the planting. So you have open glades, you have woods, you have lots of laurel, and lots of box, but not rigid. Everything loose. And of course, at the time, nature, particularly in the poetry, is always seen as a feminine spirit, and so he's caressing nature. It's nature's tresses that, mm, he is trying to smooth out for,
yeah,
us.
But then you sort of have the contrast. You have some very masculine statues and,
yes,
things like that, don't you? Sort of,
yes,
looming out of some of the trees.
Exactly. Yes.
Can you tell us about some of the key pieces here?
Well, probably the most important one is the Antinous, and it's interesting that, you know, my take on it is that it is Hadrian's male lover, mm-hmm, who died rather mysteriously in the Nile, because at the feet of the Antinous statue there are rushes suggestive of a river in the Nile. In the past it's been called the Apollo, or it's been called the Colossus.
Yeah.
One of the difficulties is that McClary, the head gardener, writes about this garden and takes us on a tour of the garden, so we know which way to do it. And he's not quite sure what it is, but
no,
he's a gardener. In my view, it is the Antinous, because General Dormer was very interested in this ideal of male beauty, and he had three bronzes in the house of the Antinous, so I'm pretty confident it's the Antinous. But then at other parts of the garden you will have a statue of Ceres, statue, mm, of Flora, so there are feminine as well as masculine,
yeah,
statues. But this is all part of the binary nature of the garden. The garden has chaste elements and rather sort of sexy elements.
Mm.
It has classicism, which is rational, and it has a Gothic, which is exotic,
yeah,
and rather romantic. It has light and it has shade. So it's this sort of binary notion all the time throughout the whole of the garden as you're walking through it.
And after Kent's death, did it change very much at all? Is it now today as it would have been back then?
Yeah, well, this is what's so fantastic, and I'm sure the family won't mind me saying this, is that they have not had huge loads of money coming in at different generations to change everything. This garden's been here since it was finished in the 1740s. It's probably the rarest garden for that reason in the whole of the country because it's so unchanged. And the Dormers, and now they're the Cottrell Dormers, Charles and Angela, have done the most wonderful thing here in restoring it and maintaining it so that all of the laurels, for instance, are at the right height. They have to be at the right height, particularly for moonlight, because they reflect moonlight beautifully. And they've got to be about 4 foot high, not more than that.
Yeah.
And you go to some gardens and they've grown over too much.
Yeah.
But the great thing about the owners here is that they are very intelligent and sophisticated about what they've got. They realise quite how important it is. I mean, we're sitting here in Praeneste on a seat designed, one of seven, designed by Kent. And it's the most beautiful, beautiful seat. It looks like a piece of Wedgwood,
but it's
50 years earlier.
Yeah.
This is how important Kent is. He is very prescient in his views about landscape gardening, about architecture, and about furniture as well. He's a polymath.
Yes.
And one of the great polymaths of the 18th century.
Yeah. Did he have any input into the house at all?
Yes, he did the library, extraordinary library with a very weird canopied roof, and also the parlour. And the parlour is very interesting because it's got very early grotesque work, which is a sort of decorative work based on antique sources on the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, Pan is in that ceiling, and we've got a statue of Pan here in the garden.
Yeah.
So he was trying to create a room that, at least with the ceiling, connected with what he was trying to do in the gardens.
Where did this kind of passion for the classical and the Gothic come from? Was that new in the 18th century?
Yes, I suppose it was. I mean, certainly the early part of the century, all of the Whig aristocracy that, you know, obviously were in power from 1714 when George I came over, they were all interested in the antique past. They all went on the grand tour, the aristocrats we're talking about, and they were looking back to Augustan Rome. And the way to look back to Augustan Rome was to go on the grand tour and to see all of the antique buildings that survived. Kent, as I said, spent 9 years in Rome, so he comes back to England, works with Burlington, and Burlington tries to create an antique style with Kent by looking back to the antique world, and this is what this is all about here at Rousham. As the 1730s and 40s progressed, we started to get to know a lot more about the history of our own country. The great cathedrals books were written in the 1720s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And people then started to get interested in a national, indigenous, native style, which of course is Gothic. So here in this garden, we have classical buildings, which are antique, and we also have little Gothic buildings, which are much more to do with England's past.
Yeah. Yeah, and what came after the landscape garden? How did it evolve?
The wretched Capability Brown, sadly.
Right. you're not a fan, or?
Well, I'm not a fan because, I mean, as you can see, I think this is probably one of the greatest gardens in the country.
It's very
so
beautiful, yeah.
And it's so simple,
and
it's so wonderfully interactive. I mean, what's interesting going around it? We haven't been able to see it very much, have we? But we've been able to walk it and then be surprised by what we've seen.
Yes,
The problem with gardens beforehand, the big formal gardens, you just stand on a terrace and you can see everything. The problem with the gardens after this period, in the 1760s and 70s, when Brown really gets going, is that they are just parks. They're landscape parks. Now, they were laid out for aristocrats who wanted shooting estates. They wanted to, you know, slaughter all these birds on the wing. They wanted to ride around in fast carriages. They wanted parks to look like ordinary, natural landscape. And that's what Brown gave them.
Yeah.
But we lost all the intellectual engagement because of that. We lost all the garden buildings. And actually, we lost a lot of people because lots of people in the landscape were taken away from the landscape. So that's why I'm not really a fan. I mean, I like gardens to intellectually engage me. And in my teaching, this is what I try and tell all my students. You know, too often people go around gardens and they're very passive.
Yes.
They just look at things, oh, a lovely show of daffs there, and oh, that's a nice parterre, and oh, I bet they have to do a lot of dusting in this room.
Yeah.
Oh. And I want people to engage with how they engage with gardens at the time.
Yeah.
And this is the great period for it, from about 1730 to around about 1760, because by 1760, Brown is doing all his great, big landscape gardens like Blenheim, Bowood, Petworth, huge, huge parklands. But what can you do with them? What can you see in them? You just walk them. The lakes are beautifully designed. They've got shelter belts on the outside. They've got clumps of trees. There may be a boathouse. That's it.
Yeah. It's all sort of handed to you on a plate, isn't it, really, those sorts of gardens?
It is. And, I mean, it's the pendulum swing as well. We've lost the intellectual element that we've got here. We then get Brown. And then, of course, Brown's successor is Humphrey Repton. And Humphrey Repton comes along and thinks, well, I've got to try and do a Brown to start with because I'm his self-styled successor. But he suddenly realises that it'd be nice to bring people back into the garden. It'd be nice to get garden buildings in. Actually, it'd be nice to bring flowers back.
Yeah.
So he then starts to create a completely new design from about 1792.
And did Kent have much to do with the planting and the types of flowers and trees and plants that were...
Very little, very little. I think his designing is garden buildings particularly, and we have loads and loads of drawings of his for all the garden buildings. The actual layout he would have talked through, probably with the head steward, a man called White here, as well as McClary, John McClary, the head gardener. But in terms of the actual plants themselves, not very much. His drawings have got fir trees, and they have got box hedges. I don't even think, you know, you can see a laurel, although laurels are very much of this period. We tend to think of those as 19th century plants, but they are very much part of this garden. Okay. So no, I mean, unlike someone like Repton, who would know a lot more about plants, Kent is green and white. Greenery, often evergreenery, white classical garden buildings. Yeah.
There's also some practical elements to the garden as well. We were walking around earlier when we were doing the photos, and you pointed out like a plunge pool, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
That was part of the original garden?
Yes.
Yeah?
That we think is probably a Bridgman feature that, again, Kent softens and makes more natural.
Yeah.
And it's a rill with water running through it. If McClary's letter to his employers, telling them desperately to come back to Rousham because there's this wonderful garden, they're off in London, this is the next generation after General Dormer. There were fish in that rill, and
were
fish
there?
Going into the octagonal cold bath.
Oh, wow.
And it was a cold bath. Next to it was a little kiosk where you would change, and men would strip naked, and they would take the cold water as part of what was called their regimen, which is to us, going down the gym, like I was this morning. Before I came out here, it's, you know, to keep yourself fit and active. Riding obviously is terribly important, but also is taking cold water. So this would be men only.
I was going to say,
ladies would be having a cup of tea somewhere else,
strolling around the gardens. Yes,
and this is what we've sort of lost a bit. I mean, we tend to go and visit gardens, and those of us who are fortunate to have gardens will tend them. But in the 18th century, these were places for people to eat, for people to talk to one another, to converse. I mean, Esher, Kent's wonderful garden, there's a portrait of Thomas Pelham, and he's sitting in a garden building with his secretary doing matters of state, doing business.
Yeah.
So we've seemed to have lost that notion that gardens were so important for people to get away from teeming servants, to have privacy, to go and be together. And we were talking earlier as we were doing the photo shoot, all of Jane Austen's proposals take place in gardens and generally in shrubberies where you can be private.
Yeah, and there's lots of little kind of nooks and crannies to these gardens, aren't there? Lots of little buildings and statues. They're absolutely beautiful gardens, so it's sort of a bit of a hidden gem, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I mean, if I can say again something about the way it's presented.
Please do.
You go to a National Trust property, and, you know, I've got nothing about the National Trust. They do a wonderful thing, and, you know, you have a lovely tea room or a restaurant, and it's got local produce, and everything is organised for you. Here in the garden, there is nothing. You buy a ticket at a ticket machine, and you walk the gardens. There's no tea shop. There's no razzmatazz. There's actually no signage. So this is a garden that you need to understand, in a sense, before you come here. But this is the great thing about it. It's here to be explored. And if you read the right things before you come, you can appreciate it. Children under 15 are not even allowed. And again, many people might think that that's wrong. But this is a garden for the older intellect. When I say the older intellect, post 15, you know, my daughter can come next year at last.
Yeah.
But it's the way that it's presented. You know, there are windfalls that you can take by the ticket machine, and this is in a sense how gardens always were.
Yeah.
And we've made this industry of them. Good things about it and bad things about it. But this is why I love this place so much. Mm. I don't feel as though I'm going to be here with anybody else. And we've been here all morning.
Mm.
We've not met anybody.
No. And just finally, we walked past another statue earlier of a lion attacking...
Lion attacking a horse.
Yes.
Well, again, what's so exciting about this garden, it's rather a bit like modern art, you know. You can make whatever interpretation you want of it. But my view, I think, is that that's untamed nature, which is the lion, and tamed nature, which is the horse. Because, you know, man tames a horse, whereas, you know, unless you're a lion tamer in a circus, you can't really tame lions. So I think you have wild nature and tamed nature, just like you have here in the garden. So I think that's one thread. But I think the other one is that it's quite an horrific statue, do you think?
Yeah, it is. It's quite shocking when you walk past it.
Yeah.
You know, just make you stop.
I think it's all part of a walk through the garden at that point that is trying to explain to you the horrors of war.
Right, okay, yes.
So you've got that really horrific image, and then you walk from that statue into a very, very dark area of the landscape. We know that because it was planted up with very, very dark plants. And you walk past that with very, very few views out, and then you come to a clearing, so light and shade again. He's always manipulating light and shade. And when you get to the clearing, in the middle of the clearing, there is the Dying Gladiator, which is a very famous statue. It's a copy of it in stone.
Yeah.
And that, again, is suggestive of war and death, mortality. And the great thing about this is that when Kent was designing it, General Dormer, who, of course, had been a really important military figure, was, in fact, dying.
So do you think that maybe inspires...
Yeah, I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it. And this is why, as I say, unless you understand these things, unless you know, spend half an hour just reading up about it before you come here, you get so much more out of the garden.
That was Timothy Mole from the University of Buckingham. You can read Timothy's feature on English landscape gardens in our July issue, which is out now. Also in our July issue, we take a look inside the mind of Richard III, we explore some myths of the Wild West, we find out why the Battle of Bannockburn became so integral to Scottish history, and discover the story of the Victorian letter scammers. You can get hold of our July issue now in all good newsagents and digitally. Meanwhile, tickets are still on sale for our 2014 History Weekend Festival, taking place from the 16th and 19th of October in the Wiltshire town of Malmesbury. The festival features talks from dozens of leading historians, authors and broadcasters. For more information and to purchase tickets, please visit the festival website historyweekend.com. And since last week, another talk has sold out, so please do get hold of your tickets soon to avoid disappointment. And now we have a short advertisement break.
Available in all major booksellers, July Crisis is a landmark account of the catalytic events that led to the outbreak of the First World War. Here, author Thomas Otte explains what was different about 1914, given that other crises have been managed without an outbreak of war.
It seems to me that at the root of the July Crisis, 1914, at the root of my book, is that strange dialogue between systemic constraints and the actions of individuals. If individual politicians had taken different decisions, the crisis would have evolved in a different way, and it is quite possible that war could have been avoided. Indeed, I'm firmly convinced of the fact that it was not inevitable that war would break out in 1914.
Joanna Burke, author of The Story of Pain, discusses how our understanding of pain has changed over time.
I really enjoyed writing this book. I think there are a lot of reasons why I became interested in the history of pain. I think the most important reason is that it's something we all think we know. It's something we all experience. We all think we know what pain is, and certainly when we're in pain, we do know what it is. But actually, when you look historically, actually we don't know what pain is. And I just found that really interesting. I'm fascinated by the different ways that people in the past have understood physical and psychological ailments. I'm really interested in the languages that people have used to talk about their suffering and the suffering of other people, because of course pain is not only about us, it's also about our loved ones, it's about people we see in the street who are suffering and our responses to them.
The Story of Pain is now available online and in all major bookshops, priced at £20.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now, unless you've been living in a cave these past few weeks, it can't have escaped your attention that the Football World Cup is currently taking place in Brazil. To mark the occasion, our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, interviewed Andreas Campomar, author of Golazo, A History of Latin American Football. Andreas is the great-grandnephew of Dr. Enrique Boero, the man who convinced Jules Rimet to stage the first World Cup in Uruguay.
Andreas, my first question is, why did you decide to write a book about the history of Latin American football?
It came to me a few years ago. I happen to be Uruguayan, but I've been brought up in the UK and spent a lot of years here. And for Uruguay, football has a lot of significance. We won the World Cup in 1930 and 1950, but even before that, we won gold medals at the Olympics in 1924 and 1928. I sought to write a book essentially about Latin American identity and how football impacts the region. And coincidentally, the book came out just before the World Cup, and that's what we were aiming for.
One of the first things I noticed when reading the book was that you challenged the myth that football was brought to Latin America by dockers and sailors playing football on the quaysides. How did it arrive in Latin America if that wasn't the case?
It arrived in Latin America through the British. And as we all know, the British are very good with inventing sports, as they invent most sports. But I think the thing about the British was when they came to Latin America, as with other parts of the globe, where they had an empire. In Latin America, they had what I would call an informal empire, i.e. they never really sought to colonize the region. But what they did was they had a hand in economics, infrastructure, etc. So they ran the railways, the electricity companies, and what have you. in doing so, they set up clubs. And they had their own little clubs where they would all congregate together. And that was very important for you know, Englishmen abroad, as it were. And part of these clubs, they would, you know, would be sporting events. So what they really did was they brought cricket to Latin America first, and then a form of kind of rugby come football before the rules came into play in the mid to late 19th century. And then, of course, football. But the thing about the British is they never sought to proselytize. They never sought to go out and spread the word. It just happened that they played the game. The Latin Americans saw that this was something worth playing and took on the game and actually ended up playing it better than the British. So essentially what it is, it's a British sport that is played at, you know, at clubs, you know, local clubs in Argentina, in Uruguay, in Peru, in Chile, but then suddenly comes out. That's not to say that actually there weren't kickabouts by sailors at the docks, you know, everywhere from Brazil through to Argentina, through to Chile, and up to Peru to Mexico. But I think it's a rather kind of nice, roseate view of, you know, how football came to the continent.
Yeah. So did it start life as a sort of an upper class game then in some ways?
Well, I think so, because the thing is, the British were always seen as, of course, more sophisticated. Britain had an empire, etc. So there was that link between these sports and a certain prestige that the British lent to them. And I think, firstly, you know, the local Creole elites started to play, and then it really drilled down into the kind of working classes and, you know, immigrant parts of society.
So when are we talking? When did the masses really start to embrace the game?
Well, I think the masses start to embrace the game probably in a smallish sense in the late 19th century, but really in the 1910s and 1920s. And what you see is a lot of clubs. So, for instance, Alumni Club, which is an Argentine club that stems from alumni from an English school. They are, you know, one of the great Argentine teams. But the problem is they run out of players because, you know, unless you're an alumni of the school, you can't really play. Whereas the other local teams have a, you know, mass of, you know, of immigrants from which they can choose. So that's what you have. You have these kind of elite clubs dying out and either becoming, you know, local clubs that have a kind of broader scope, and then thereby developing into kind of mass clubs.
Why did the people of Latin America embrace a game with such passion? Why is football so synonymous with Latin America, you know, to a greater extent even than sort of here in Britain or places like Spain and Italy?
Well, I think it's just happened to be the fact that they were good at it. And they were good at it very early and they learned quickly. And it was a game that was easily played. And one of the great mythologies, and this is true, is that all around Latin America, kids would play on, you know, basically what is kind of wasteland or scrubland, basically a sock or some stocking filled with, you know, a stone and some newspaper and what have you, and have a kick around. And that's part of the great mythology, because people can afford to buy leather balls. So that's how they played this game, and they became good at it, and they enjoyed playing it. And it wasn't professionalized until much later. But this helped it develop. And I think also the fact that Uruguay won those two gold medals, as I said, in 1924 in Paris and in Amsterdam in 1928, really got the region going, that actually Latin Americans can compete. And then when Uruguay won the 1930 World Cup at home in Montevideo, they then thought, well, you know, this is what we can do. This is what we do, and this is how we compete. And also, going back to, you asked the question as to why I wrote this book, is that I realized that the North Americans don't really understand us in Latin America. Western Europe is more interested in the Far East or Africa. And so every 4 years, we have this thing, which is the World Cup, where actually Latin Americans really do excel. I mean, it's usually the Brazilians, but, you know, this is something we're very, very good at.
Was it to a certain extent an expression of sort of freedom and independence after sort of years of domination by European powers? I mean, was football used as a vehicle for that in any respect?
Yes, I think it's very similar. I mean, there are great parallels with the West Indies cricket culture. And C.L.R. James in Beyond a Boundary talks about this, that when the West Indies really come to the fore, they join, as I think, to quote him, the Committee of Nations. And so too the Latin American states. They knew very early on that actually this is something that gave them identity, especially in Uruguay. My great-granduncle wrote, he was a diplomat, wrote a letter to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying, if we win gold in the 1924 Olympics, we will really become part of, you know, the great nations. And I think for them it was, one, a sense of being, having their own identity. So each, you know, country having its own discrete identity, because you have to remember that Latin America, through the wars of independence in the early to mid-19th century, these are false borders for the most. They're not real borders, as it were. So football in the 20th century became a way of distinguishing each country from another. So, you know, football playing, if you're Chilean, you play against Peru, that means that you're playing in a different way. And if you're playing in a different way and you have a different mentality in relation to the game, therefore you have a certain type of Chileanness or a Peruvianness that may not be distinct in day-to-day life. It gives countries their discrete cultures. So, for instance, all Latin Americans play in a similar way, but yet at the same time they play very differently. So Peru has a more Brazilian flavour. You know, Argentinian and Uruguayan football are very similar.
In what way are they similar? So how would Uruguayan and Argentinian football, how would they be similar and how would they be differentiated from Brazilian football?
Well, I think the thing is that you have to go back to the late 19th century that Argentina, Buenos Aires, Argentina's capital, and Montevideo, Uruguay's capital, very close together. There's a geographical proximity, which meant they could play each other regularly, and they had regular matches, both at international and domestic level. So club teams, but also Uruguayan and Argentine 11s. And they did this with cricket in the 1860s. The thing about the other countries is that if you have a look at Chile, for instance, or Peru, that, you know, if Chile wants to play Argentina, it has to cross the Andes and make a long journey in order to play any kind of competitive match. Playing Peru, the same thing, you know, it needs to travel north. So what you have is a symbiotic relationship in the River Plate where they play each other quite often, and that develops the competition. Brazil, being further away, didn't have that. So Brazil takes longer to develop its football. And I think it's very important that competition and proximity means that, you know, the football becomes much more sophisticated. If you look at Mexico and the Central American republics, their football doesn't develop until much later and doesn't become competitive, you know, until, you know, the 1950s and 1960s.
How fierce did these rivalries get between the different nations on, you know, on the football pitch?
They love and hate each other. I mean, I think García Márquez said that he didn't feel that at home in Spain, but he felt at home in most Latin American countries, even though we're all divided by borders. There is this sense of, you know, pan-Latin American community, which I think is very important, that even if you're from Uruguay, but you meet a Colombian, there is a sense of a common Latin American culture, even though every country has its own culture. But I think on the football pitch, people take great pride in distinguishing themselves from the other. Say, for instance, Brazil and Uruguay have this nice, you know, competitive spirit. And one of the reasons for that is because Uruguay beat Brazil in the 1950 World Cup final. And the ghosts of Maracana still loom large, and not as great as before, because Brazil has gone on to win numerous World Cups. Argentina and Brazil have a fierce rivalry because they are the two footballing superpowers in the region. There's a rivalry between Chile and Peru, and that goes back to the War of the Pacific in the late 19th century, where Peru was decimated by Chile. Peru shouldn't have been beaten by Chile, but they were. So the sense of inferiority still looms large in the Peruvian mentality. So for Peru, let's put it this way, if Peru draws against Argentina, it's really seen as a win. But the big powers in the region are Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and actually Paraguay, which I think, you know, has a great footballing tradition. Although some Paraguayans will say they don't have a style. They are very, very fierce, and they're very heroic in their play. They don't give up. I mean, there's a certain thing about Latin American countries is they do give up. You know, if you put two or three goals past them, that's it. Whereas if you have a look at England or Germany or, you know, the Northern European nations, they do battle till the very end.
You talk in the book about sort of the intricate relationship between football and politics in Latin America. I mean, when did politicians sort of first realise they could sort of use football as a means to furthering their own ambitions?
Well, I think it happens early in the sense that politicians become wise to the fact that actually this game, which is, you know, 11 men on each side with a ball and a referee, umpire, they realize that it attracts the masses. And that becomes very important for Latin American politicians, especially populist politicians. So very early on, when, especially if you have a look at Argentina, which hosted large matches, and also Brazil, that politicians do arrive at these matches in the 1910s, and they realize that, you know, people are interested, and actually they, you know, tether themselves to, you know, football, because it engenders a kind of public spirit, a kind of carnival atmosphere, but also its power. And you see that throughout the 20th century, that every time a nation wins, the politicians, whether they like football or not. And one thing you have to remember is the fact that a lot of Latin American politicians didn't particularly like football. Say Perón, for instance, was ambivalent about the game, but knew that it had this huge power and huge draw in Argentina. And therefore, he felt it to be very, very important. So I think for all Latin American politicians, it is an important factor, because it just has such a huge following, as is the case here in the UK. I mean, it's no different in many respects.
And did that apply especially to the World Cup in Argentina in 1978? Did a victory there help sustain the military regime?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's hard to say. I think it gave Argentinians a sense of, you know, things weren't as bad. And there was this, you know, fiesta, this great party atmosphere afterwards, which actually suspended disbelief, the atrocities that were happening in the country. I think that if Argentina had gone out in the first round, the population may have turned on them. But as we know, it really did take the you know, the War of the Falklands, the Malvinas, to bring an end to the government.
And on the subject of the Falklands, how important was it to Argentina to beat England in the 1986 World Cup finals? I mean, did the Falklands factor really, was that a source of motivation to the Argentinian team?
I think so. I think the way the Malvinas or the Falklands loom large and a part of Argentine identity is not to be underestimated. For a lot of the British, I mean, until 1982, they didn't know where these islands were. For the Argentines, they see it as part of their, empire, as it were, within the region. And I think that every child is kind of brought up with the idea that the Falklands is theirs. The problem for the 1982 squad was when they got to Europe, they realized that, you know, despite the hype and the fact that the propaganda that Argentina may have been winning the war, they realized when they came to Europe it wasn't thus. And then, of course, Britain won. So by the 4 years later, I think it was a factor. There are conflicting accounts. I mean, a lot of the Argentines are on record before the match as saying, actually, it has nothing to do with football. But actually, after the match, they did change their tune, some of them, especially Diego Maradona. And I think it does have a huge influence, that the Argentines do see the British as pirates. And part of that is the fact that, you know, they occupy, you know, these islands in the South Atlantic, which have a kind of dubious history anyhow. I mean, Darwin said it was one of the worst places in the world. So I think it does have an important factor, yes.
Why are Latin Americans so good at football? I mean, they basically beat the Europeans at their own game. I mean, what do you think is the reason for that?
I think it's just enjoying the game. I think that's from an early age. They love the ball, and they love doing things with the ball. And also, you have to remember that this is Latin America. So they're prone to that Hispanic or Italian artistry and a sense of vanity as well, i.e. they like to show off. So the thing is, if you give Latin Americans a crowd, they will want to entertain. Whereas I think Northern European nations, for the most part, want to get a job done. You know, they want a victory. And actually, sometimes it doesn't really matter how you acquire the victory. But there is a sense of artistry. And also, I think the thing is, especially for England, and I said this the other day, but I do feel that, you know, English players are somehow scared of the ball. And I think this comes down to coaching. So if you go to, you know, any Sunday league match or, you know, kids playing in the park, there's always shouting. And you hear parents shout this from the sidelines and coaches, man on, get rid, boot it upfield. And it's the idea of getting rid of the ball, whereas in Latin America, you want to keep the ball, and you want to keep the ball for as long as possible. And you want to do things with the ball, and you want to evade your marker and dribble around and do all kinds of, you know, tricks. I mean, here in this country, we call it showboating, which probably it's got a negative connotation. And that's the thing, whereas there, you know, people do applaud it. And if you have a look at some of great English players, I mean, for instance, Glenn Hoddle. I mean, I think Glenn Hoddle, had he been, you know, Spanish or Latin American or even French, I think he would have had double the number of caps that he did have. I applaud his skill. I think he's one of, you know, the greatest English players that I've seen in my lifetime. But I think someone like that down there would be, you know, par for the course and not seen as a luxury, which he was in England.
When did the first Latin American teams tour Europe, and what kind of impact did they have on the European audience?
The touring teams, that was very important for Latin America because they'd played each other. And by that time, by the 1920s, you know, Uruguay had won its first gold medal in Paris in 1924. But they had played each other, and they played each other regularly, and they played what was called the South American Championship. And in 1916, Uruguay won it, and they played one match. I think they beat Chile by 4-0, and they fielded two black players. They were black or Afro-Uruguayan players, and the Chileans wanted the match annulled because they thought that Uruguay was cheating by using African slaves. So the thing is, they had played each other regularly. But it was only in Europe that Latin American identity was crystallized. And I think this is the very important thing to consider, that by coming to Europe and succeeding in Europe, and you have, you know, Nacional coming from Uruguay, you have Boca coming from Argentina, you have Brazilian teams, then you have Chilean teams, you have Colo-Colo coming to Europe. And in succeeding in Europe, and also remember these games were reported on, and there's nothing better for Latin Americans than succeeding abroad. It somehow crystallizes their sense of Uruguayanness or Argentinianness or Chileanness. And I think that's very important, that it somehow meant that the rest of the world were, one, watching, and two, they were beating the old world at their game. And I think that was very, very important for all these teams, not just on a kind of domestic club level, but on an international level. So even if it wasn't your team coming to Europe, the fact that the team was representing your country was very, very important.
You mention in your book the Great River Plate side of the early 1940s. And would you consider them to be the greatest Latin American team of all time, or at least the most influential?
Yes, I think, especially because it was the 1940s, and remember that Latin America was isolated at the time. So people watched Argentina. Also, there was a magazine called El Gráfico, which still is. I mean, it's a monthly magazine now, but it was a kind of sporting weekly at the time. And it would be, you know, disseminated around the region. And I think that that team loomed large in the imagination of all Latin Americans, because not every country had its own sporting publication. So these great wins by River, or La Máquina, the machine as it was called, loomed large in the imagination. So I think of a golden age of football, I think it is, yes, one of the great teams. I would also say Santos, you know, Pelé's team, was also, you know, a great team, especially in the 1960s. But I think just for the kind of the glory of the game, I mean, for me, La Máquina is probably the great team. And not just, you know, because of its results, but just the way the team played and actually what it meant for the game as well.
Now, in the 21st century, in fact, for the possibly, I guess, is the last 20 years, it seems that the best Latin American footballers have automatically moved to Europe at quite a young age. I mean, what effect is that having on the game at home?
Well, the thing is that, you know, the best football is being played in Europe. There's no doubt about that. Latin America is a great exporter of players. Even though I'm Uruguayan, I still find it amazing that a population of over 3 million people can produce just one fantastic player after another. Suarez being, you know, I think one of the most exciting players, you know, we have in the UK at the moment. But the thing is that what you find is that Messi, for instance, may be the new breed of Latin American player, i.e. born in the region, but never having played, you know, football at senior level. So he doesn't have those allegiances to the kind of grassroots there, which I think is important for a lot of Latin American players. Though it seems not to have made any difference with Messi, who, you know, is an absolutely exceptional player. But it is an exporter, and actually the football in Latin America is, I mean, to my mind, there's a lot of it. There's probably too much of it, too many tournaments, crazy fixture lists, but it still produces competitive football. I don't think it's particularly good on the whole. And I think that, you know, people, when they go over there, you know, it's a great spectacle. But I think in terms of football, it's sometimes rather disappointing. But still, it produces a kind of breed of players that find their way to Europe and all around the world, as it were, that do extremely well.
Now, I'm just going to quickly turn to sort of the dark side of South American football. And one of the most tragic incidents was 20 years ago was the killing of Andres Escobar following Colombia's exit from the 1994 World Cup. I mean, how did that come about?
Colombia, from the 1940s onwards, has been a pretty volatile nation, and it hasn't been helped by a kind of rampant drug export culture. And so, you know, when you bring, you know, drugs and the game together, there would always be fallout. We are unsure what happened to Escobar on that night, and there are various ideas as to what may have happened. But it is one of the great tragedies of, you know, Latin American society, and we see this in Mexico at the moment, you know, with cartel killings. It just happened. It could have been anyone else, I think. And he just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. Whether he was killed for scoring the own goal, you know, I'm not sure. Some people say yes, some people say no. It was just a premise that made the tragedy happen. So, you know, Colombia, I mean, it's not as dangerous as people might think, but I think the cartels have never helped, you know, the situation there.
Are you surprised that there's been so much unrest in Brazil ahead of this World Cup?
Yes and no. I think Brazil has, as a culture, overcome the ghosts of Maracanã of 1950, although Uruguayans will tell you otherwise. But I think they are the world's best tournament team, and I think their record speaks for itself. I'm not surprised, therefore, that people have turned on the World Cup, because actually, in many ways, there is nothing left to prove, because it has the best World Cup record. Moreover, and I think more importantly, it has become, or Brazil has become, everyone's, you know, second favorite team. So if your European team, you know, goes out of the competition, who are you going to support? Probably Brazil. So it's got this worldwide fan base. So I think it's come to terms with, you know, its football, which it didn't for a long time after the 1950 World Cup. You know, it took those quick victories in 1958, 1962, and 1970 to put that World Cup, the tragedy of 1950, behind it. So I'm not surprised at all. And I'm not surprised that, you know, people have said, well, actually, you know, do we really need this here? You know, aren't there, you know, better or more worthy causes for the country to spend its money on? So no, I don't think it's surprised me in the least.
Now, you're going to be at the World Cup, so I can't let you go without asking for a prediction of how Uruguay are going to get on against England.
I think England have, I'm smiling here, I think England have a pretty good chance. And I think the great thing about England, actually, is, although I don't support England, is the fact that Hodgson, I think, has played a blinder in the sense that there are no expectations at all. You know, for once, there's no idea that we're going to win it. You know, we're going to beat Brazil in Brazil. So I think England may surprise people. And also, they've got a young team and actually quite a, you know, dynamic team. So barring injury, etc., I think Uruguay don't fear England. My fear is that Italy in the group, you know, a few people have spoken about, but in that group, I think Italy is the kind of dark, you know, the dark horse, and I think they are a tough team to beat. But if you want a prediction, I think Argentina may do it, and I think Argentina not just because they have a talented team and they play wonderful football. It's because they will want to beat Brazil in Brazil. And I think that a lot of teams, and I think psychology comes into play. So, for instance, a Latin American team would rather play Spain, the world champions, than a Northern European team. Because Spain, they understand, you know, that football, they know how to deal with. Also, I think there are a lot of Latin Americans who don't rate Spanish football because, you know, Spanish football, I mean, it doesn't have the same illustrious history as Latin American football, and has only started to come to the fore, you know, in the last 5 years or so. So I think that's important. But I think, you know, Uruguayans would rather play Spain than play Germany, for instance. And I think, you know, the Argentinians have learnt this, that actually playing Germany is tough. You know, it's not easy. So in the last World Cup, if memory serves me right, you know, they were massacred. Argentina was massacred by Germany. But then for weeks or so, or a couple of months after the World Cup, Spain, the world champions, went down to Argentina, I think were beaten 4-0 or something. So psychologically, it's important. And I think a lot of, you know, European teams will go there and feel they won't be able to beat Brazil at home. The thing about Argentina is I think Argentina will feel they can take Brazil. And I think nothing will give them more pleasure than beating Brazil in Brazil. And if it comes to it, a final.
That was Spencer Mizzen talking to Andreas Campomar. Golazzo, A History of Latin American Football, is out now, published by Quercus. And of course, if you're in the UK, you can watch games from the World Cup live on BBC Television and listen on BBC Radio. Okay, so that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we'll do our best to read out some of them in the future. The debate on our theme music continues to run. Bernd, who's listening from Germany, has written in to say, please do not change your theme music. Meanwhile, Andrew Watts, whose comments began this discussion, has got back in touch to say, hooray for the lady who agreed with me about the theme tune. How about The Clash, London Calling? Iconically and unmistakably British, arguably historic in the social sense anyway, and wholly appropriate for the BBC. Thanks for that, Andrew, and please do keep your thoughts coming in. And as well as email, you can also get in touch with us on social media. On Twitter, we're at History Extra, and on Facebook, we're also History Extra. And do make sure to visit our website, historyextra.com, for all the latest history news, galleries, quizzes, articles, and you can also listen to previous episodes of this podcast that go back to 2007. Next week, we're going to be joined by Kwasi Kwarteng to discuss the history of finance and war, and Richard Van Emden will be explaining what life was like for First World War soldiers. Do listen in for that. This History Extra podcast was recorded on location in Oxfordshire and in Bristol, and produced by Jack Fletcher.